Welcome to the Good Reading Podcast, proudly sponsored by Book People Gift Cards. A Book People gift card is the perfect gift for readers of all ages. Simply order your gift card online at bookpeoplegiftcards.org.au. Redeem at any one of over 500 bookshops across Australia. Visit bookpeoplegiftcards.org.au. Dr. Vanessa Perotta is a wildlife scientist, science communicator, and author. Vanessa has represented Australia at the International Science Communication Competition FameLab, been recognised as one of the top 100 women of influence, and listed as one of Science and Technology Australia's superstars of STEM. Vanessa is also the lead in the citizen science program Wild Sydney Harbour. Vanessa is the author of two children's books, The Voyage of the Whale Calf and Oceans at Night. But today I'm talking to Vanessa about her very first book for adults, Humpback Highway, Diving into the Mysterious World of Whales. Vanessa, welcome to the Good Reading Podcast.
Thank you for having me. I am so excited to be telling all your readers about my book.
Whales are certainly a thing we should get excited about. But my first question is, how did you become a whale scientist?
I never, ever, ever in a million years thought I would be a whale scientist. When I was a little girl, I wanted to be a dolphin trainer. It was the movie Free Willy back in the day that I just loved. And so for me, it was a little farm girl who grew up on a farm outside of Canberra. I just wanted to be that dolphin trainer. And without giving too much away, I did get to that point, but then other things happened in my life. And then it went down a very exciting journey of discovery and ending up to being Dr. Vanessa Perotta, which I never thought would happen. And it's an exciting one that just keeps surprising me to this day.
And here we are. And your book is called Humpback Highway. What is the Humpback Highway? How far does it extend and why is it so important?
Well, the Humpback Highway is something that your listeners probably watch every single year and don't think about it. The Humpback Highway is that migratory corridor that humpback whales travel along the east and the west coast of Australia. They will migrate from Antarctica over the summer, so they spend the summer feeding, and then they'll switch directions when it turns to wintertime or towards wintertime, and they'll travel along the Humpback Highway to those warm breeding waters in Australia's northern waters. And this book has been something that I've desperately wanted to do for big kids. I've got my children's resource, which is a resource for whale book, a whale knowledge rather. That's The Voyage of Whale and Calf. And now The Humpback Highway. This is a book which is an annual migratory journey to tell the reader why it is that these whales are doing what they do.
So we know that whales, and particularly humpback whales, use this highway, but who else rides the humpback highway?
Well, we could say that Finding Nemo rides the humpback highway just the other way down on the southward migration, which is referring to the East Australian Current, which is that famous body of warm water coming down the coast. You've got bull sharks that travel along the humpback highway. They come into the harbour around autumn. We also have other whales, so dwarf minke whales. They're the ones that sound like the Star Wars whale, like the boing, boing noises. You might have the southern right whale, then obviously the humpback whale. There's so many things that are happening in the ocean. And with changes in the environment, we're now seeing a lot of tropical animals down far south as Tasmania, which means some of those animals might have come down the humpback highway because it's becoming a lot warmer further south.
You're a whale scientist and you've devoted many years of your life to the study of whales, and yet you write, I don't know much about whales. How can that be?
The irony. It's just I've written an entire book, many books now on whales, and it's true. The reason I say that is because I think it's important for us as scientists to acknowledge that when we study something, we only learn such a small amount, and then we go into the field, we're in the water with a whale eye to eye and go, oh my gosh, we actually don't know much about them. And this is why it's important for me to tell the general audience, and I know this is a book for big kids, so to speak, but this is very much a book for year seven up, so a teenager. And the reason I wanted to put that in to tell people across demographics is because that it gives a huge appreciation as to, while we know a small amount of them, there's so much more to learn. And these creatures are really fascinating bus-sized creatures. And if you're listening to this podcast on a bus, that's as wide as a whale. Or if you're in a car, that's also as wide as a whale, maybe a bit wider, shorter rather in width. But these animals are huge, and we often forget that because sometimes we only see them for a split second at the surface and then they're gone.
First Nations people encountered whales long before we arrived on their shores. What's the First Nations people's connection to humpback whales, and what can we learn from them?
Oh, I love this because when I studied whales and did my PhD, I never had an appreciation for Indigenous knowledge. But First Nations peoples of Australia, they really are the first whale scientists. And I talk about this through my working with the Gamay Rangers, which are the local rangers in Sydney, but also exploring that very famous story of Old Tom, which was that killer whale and his pod that used to work with First Nation whalers. It's only in books that we have awareness to the European whalers that were doing this kind of thing. And I won't spoil as to what he used to do because it's super juicy and exciting. But really, it's uncovering and unpacking that connection, which for some mobs and clans, whales are their spiritual ancestors, their totems. Buri Buri is the reference that a lot of the First Nations peoples in Sydney refer to humpback whales as. So it's very special. And it's also a unique perspective and one that we can, in the science world, reflect back on these stories, which were the first, in my opinion, the first way of science communication, really. It's really powerful.
Now, this is the point in the interview where we get a bit hardcore, and that's really just a sensational way of asking about what we know about whale reproduction.
For those who might be boring and go, oh my gosh, what are we talking about now? Well, as a science student, and I love biology, it's really important to cover all grounds here. So in this book, I do talk about whale-sized reproductive organs. So everything is described that you could read to a child, or at least a young adult. And the reason being is the southern right whales, I really do pay respect to them because they're the ones that have, and this is a really interesting fact, the largest testicles in the animal world. And I'm not going to tell you how big they are because it's in the book, but you will be surprised at just how long and how big their testicles are. And the reason being is because once you read up on the sizes, the theory is that these animals, in order to ensure that their genes pass on to the next generation, ensuring that there's a large volume of sperm production is really helpful when reproducing with the female because when you first reproduce with a female, if there's other males there, the male is able to flush out the previous male's sperm with his own and then have the opportunity for his genes to be passed on. So the adaptations to be a whale, which is a mammal like you and I, is just incredible.
Now, of course, you've talked about whale fathers, but what about whale mothers? What kind of mothers are whales?
Oh my gosh, for those who just want a really feel-good story, this is the ultimate in the animal world for the ultimate mother multitasker. Humpback whales are glorious mothers, and they really do a lot of things all at the same time. I am talking, just to give you a little snapshot, talking about migrating, providing milk to their young, giving birth, making sure frisky males don't annoy her and her calf, whispering sometimes so they're not heard by killer whales. There are so many things that a mother has to do. And in the stages of pre-pregnancy, a lot of them are migrating and don't have the opportunity to snack. Like I've had two calves or children myself. And I think about now when I see a humpback whale mother, my perspective on what they do has completely changed. So when I was writing this book, I was writing this book with a small calf, but also pregnant. And then a few days after I gave birth, I was still writing this book. And for any midwife or nurse or just curious or someone who is about to be a mum, there's a really great chapter in this book for you. And don't worry, fellas, if you're turned off by this, it's an incredible thing that'll make you appreciate the mammal world and also how whales go about doing what they do and the challenges they face in parenthood. And you get to learn about the role of the male humpback whale. And I'm not going to give away what he gets up to during, let's just say, his brief moments of being a father.
Okay, we'll leave that to the reader. I didn't realize that whales could whisper. That's a very interesting fact in itself. But scientists have also developed a specialized vocabulary to describe whale behavior. Skyhop, whale fall, logging, bubble net feeding, they're just a few. As we learn more about whales and whale behavior, do you see that vocabulary expanding?
Oh, yes. Yes, definitely. The more we spend time with whales, the more we learn about them and the more we see them doing interesting things. And new tools to access whales like drones. I talk about my collaboration with Drone Shark app, which some of your listeners might go, "Oh, I watch that every day off Bondi Beach." And having eyes in the sky allows us to spy on whales and see things we've never seen before. But also, I delve into the idea of new technology, which we're placing things on whales' backs to see what they're doing underwater. My goodness me, spying on whales from space, just your mind will be blown when you learn about how we go about conserving an animal that does not recognize international borders and doesn't have an international passport. They go where they want, when they want, and we as humans have to make sure that we don't hurt them along the way.
While we're there, what is a spy hop?
Oh, yes. So a spy hop is when a whale, humpback whale, will bring its mouth and its eye out of the water and they have a look around. It's very weird. They will just stop and they have a little look around and then they come back down and then they go about doing their thing. It's kind of like checking out the area. I've been in the water with a humpback whale many times and there's been one instant where a mother has brought her arm all the way to me and I can see her baseball size eyeball or rock melon size eyeball just looking at me. These animals are completely aware of their surroundings. And when they look at you in the eye, whether it be underwater or via a boat through a spy hop, very special. It gives me chills even thinking about it.
Logging is something that humans do, but how do whales log?
Yes, so a logging in the whale world means no loss of anything. It's literally their bust-sized body hanging out at the surface like a log, kind of like the ultimate inner flop. And the animals may rest at the surface taking a breath, which sounds like this. And then they might just rest. I can recall right now my time in Antarctica seeing these two humpback whales just resting or logging at the surface with an iceberg behind them, just so picturesque. And that will is a memory of my time down south that I'll never forget.
Everybody knows that whales make sounds, and you've given us some very nice imitations of those sounds. I didn't realize that they can be as loud as a 747. How much do we know about how whales communicate through sound?
Well, the whale you're talking about is the world's loudest whale, which is a sperm whale. And they use high frequency sound to communicate. But the humpback whales, they use low frequency sounds. And low frequency sounds are designed to travel long distances, kind of like elephants on land, how they have low frequency sounds which travel kilometers. Humpback whales can do the same. And it is in the humpback whale world, the males that will only sing. Females and the calves can make moans and groans and whisper, but they don't really sing. And the reason singing occurs is most likely a result for reproductive ways. And we're only just understanding how whales are able to do this. So, as I've written this book, new research has come out on whales that I've been able to update in the book. And there's some new research that's come out and I haven't been able to update. So, we're really at a time where significant things are happening in the whale world, particularly around humpback whales, that this book is just the perfect platform for people to be up to scratch and go, yep, I'm ready for this whale season, and to use this as an annual resource, which is great.
I was also interested to read that the whale world has celebrity whales, and perhaps the world's most famous whale is Migaloo. Why is he such a celebrity?
Migaloo is probably the world's most famous humpback whale because he looks different. He's white. Now, Migaloo, what I've coined in this book, the Migaloo effect, is other people trying to see where Migaloo is. We're trying to work out where Migaloo is. Is he still alive? There have been times we haven't seen Migaloo, and that's okay. But since I've been writing this book, 2020 is the last official sighting. So it's been 4 years between swims. Will we see Migaloo? Will we not? Will we see other whales that look like Migaloo, which I refer to as the Migaloo effect, which could be young calves? Or, in fact, there are other white whales in the world, and they're the ones that people are curious about. And I think it's because people have the ability to spot what looks like an iceberg moving underwater, and that they're able to connect with at least one of the individuals in a population of over 40,000 humpback whales, which is very special.
And of course, Migaloo is not the only whale celebrity, and you referred to Old Tom just a minute ago. He's another famous whale character, if I can call him that. Tell me about Old Tom.
Biggest conspiracy thing here is Old Tom is not actually a whale. He is a killer whale, but did you know that killer whales are the largest member of the dolphin family? So there's a fact. Killer whales are long-lived. They can live up to 80 years plus, like a humpback whale. But old Tom, well, old Tom was one of the first celebrity marine creatures that I connected with because he used to be the killer whale that worked with whalers down at Eden. And he was very famous about working with whalers to find humpback whales. And again, I'm not going to go into it, but his skeleton remains and how he got to there, well, I won't give away now, but his skeleton remains in the Eden Killer Whale Museum. And just last year, as I'm writing this book, new research came out about using ancient DNA drilled in from his tooth to learn more about his group and how or if he might be related to other killer whales. But I'm not going to spoil the suspense here. I'm going to leave it to the reader's excitement to work out how important old Tom was and what we know about him in solving one of the celebrity killer whales of the world.
You've actually been mugged by a whale. I wondered what they made off with. Was it your phone, your wallet, or just your pride?
Just my emotions. Oh, to be mugged by a whale. Yeah, mugging is where there's no loss of money in the whale world. You're on a boat, you can be doing absolutely nothing, and then the whales come to you. It's an incredibly emotional piece. I actually have the clip that I was involved with for Southern Ocean Live on an ABC show where we were collecting whale snot for my research. And it is at the moment where I am mugged by two whales off Sydney, and I go from being the scientist to then just crying with emotion. Oh my gosh, I'm so embarrassed to watch myself. But often the people that see this clip will go, I cried during it, because these whales will come up to the boat. They came up out of the blue and they just were looking, they were spy hopping, they were circling our boat for hours or so. And then they just left to go make their way north to the Great Barrier Reef. I mean, what was it about our boat that was just so interesting for them to go, wow. This is incredible. What are you? I've seen you before. I've seen this is just, we're going to stop right now and just enjoy.
Of course, that leads me very nicely to the next question. It's about the way humans make contact with whales. What are the protocols, and especially with whale carcasses that might have been washed up on a beach? What should we do? What shouldn't we do?
Well, I think the thing is that there's a seriousness to this, and even in death, whales can be very dangerous to people. Their size. But they also have the potential to spread, they can be zoonotic or spread zoonosis, which is transfer of disease to humans from animals. And the best thing to do is if you see something, you should call your state authority. National parks is a great example. There are other organizations like Orca, which then can communicate by providing an additional network. My personal message is to not go anywhere near that animal, but to tell trained experts of what to do. And the reason being is, like I said before, these animals can be dangerous. They might be stressed. And if they're still alive, you don't want to stress them anymore. So people train every single year to try and respond to animals in need. And we don't exactly know why whales strand. But there's a really great book, a moment in my book where I talk about the many reasons of why this could happen. And as a scientist, one of the biggest questions I get asked or most often is, well, why do whales do this? And so I delve into this. But it is definitely a something that if you do see something, you need to tell authorities about because these animals are in need of help. But also learning more about how we deal with animals post stranding and in death, there is just so much we need to learn, and potentially from First Nations peoples as well. Indigenous knowledge and Torres Strait Islander people knowledge is just incredibly powerful. And if we can use this in the scientific world, that can only help the collaboration, but also our understanding of how we go about dealing with these situations even further.
You're also the lead scientist in a citizen science project called Wild Sydney Harbour. How does that work, and how do people get involved in that project?
Oh, so simple that one. If you are catching a ferry to work in Sydney specifically, sorry if you're external to this, or you're enjoying a walk near the harbour and you see a dolphin or a fur seal or something or a shark, let us know. Wild Sydney Harbour is a citizen science project designed to connect people with their blue backyard. So we're harnessing the power of social media to Use photos that you might have to let us know by hashtagging Wild Sydney Harbour. We also have an official survey that people can fill out on our website at wildsydneyharbour.com. And you can simply go, yep, I saw a fur seal at Sydney Opera House steps. Here it is. Here's a photo. Or, oh my gosh, I saw the dolphins today near Manly on the ferry. Hashtag Wild Sydney Harbour. Look at the dolphins. That kind of thing. Because we actually don't know much about the fur seals or the dolphins in the harbour, despite it being one of the busiest harbours in the world. So for me to have gone to Madagascar, Tonga, Antarctica, Canada to do all this research, it was during COVID that I realised that we had to connect with more about what's in our own backyard. And that's why it's so powerful. And also working with the First Nation rangers, the Gamay rangers, to document the marine life in Botany Bay or Gamay. And then potentially connecting the two is what we're working towards. And hashtag Wild Sydney Harbour.
So we've talked about the history and the research, but what about the future for humpback whales and the populations around Australia? And for that matter, globally, what is the future? What are the prospects?
Well, for some whale populations, their numbers are not doing well post-whaling, like the southern right whale. They're not recovered very well. And human impacts like ship strike, entanglement of fishing gear, climate change is a really bad thing. But then you have other whale populations like the humpback whale that has done really well now that we've stopped killing them. But as a scientist, we now need to manage so many more whales in our waters than ever. Now, that's a positive thing, but also as a scientist, we want to work together with multiple stakeholders. And we could potentially learn from changes that are going on in our ocean by studying whales, their movements, where they feed, where they go, when they turn up. That can be very powerful and informing a lot of what we choose to do in the ocean by learning more about whales. Never underestimate seeing a whale in your backyard because these animals traverse across from Antarctica to Australian waters. They can live over 50 years of age. There's so much more we need to learn about whales, especially in a changing world, but also other whales. It's not just the humpback whale out there. They are a great flagship species because we can all see humpback whales, but there are other whales that we have the opportunity to learn about and to help protect along the way. So the humpback whale is truly that ambassador species that we can all use to learn about. They're very acrobatic. They jump out of the water. They can tell us more about this is what a whale's like, and this is how we can learn more about other whales. And how does this work with the ocean changing, sea ice melting? Humpback whales feed on Antarctic krill, which are their main food source. These are small little centimeter-like creatures that live in Antarctica. If we lose sea ice due to global warming, we lose homes for krill, which means we lose the food for humpback whales. This is the ocean is all interconnected. We need whales to feed in one area, poo in another, fertilize our oceans, store carbon in their body. When they die, they fall, a whale fall, which takes carbon from our atmosphere down to the bottom of the ocean. Incredible stuff.
Well, Vanessa, it's been wonderful to talk to you. I've had a whale of a time.
Thank
And thanks so much for joining me on the Good Reading Podcast.
you, and thank you to your listeners.
I've been talking to Vanessa Perotta about her book, Humpback Highway, Diving into the Mysterious World of Whales. It's published by New South Books, and you can find it at goodreadingmagazine.com.au. My name's Greg Dobbs, and thanks for listening. This Good Reading Podcast was brought to you by Book People Gift Cards. Share the joy of reading with a Book People gift card. To find out more, visit bookpeoplegiftcards.org.au.